I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBU Radio, Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this February 6th Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll open with a preview of the 27th Annual African Film Festival, and I'll be talking with committee member P.C. Perry. We'll also have Tracy Francis on the phone. P.C. is a member of Flying Focus Video Collective as well. The festival opened this past February 3rd, and it runs through March 4th at Portland Community College. It's free and open to the public. Desiree Helgers presents voices from the February 2nd panel on Standing Rock, Lessons Learned, sponsored by the Northwest Neighborhood Chapter of 350 PDX. There are featured speakers. I will identify those speakers as we get to that segment. There's a whole host of very thoughtful folks that participated in this event. Bill Resnick discusses energy and how we can outmaneuver Trump to build operating models for clean sun and wind energy, electrified mass transit, agroecological farming, conservation of energy, and much more. His guest this morning is Rebecca Clausen. There'll be more on clean energy in a short interview to follow with Erica Edelson. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBU members, old and new, for supporting KBU and programs like the Old Mole Variety Hour. And of course, you can find the Old Mole on KBU's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. I also will have a short conversation with Pat McCurry. He's a social studies teacher, and we'll be talking about an upcoming teach-in, Teaching in Time of Trump. We'll probably be doing a lot of that kind of thing. Well, I'm here this morning with P.C. Perry. Thanks for coming down to talk about the African Film Festival. P.C., the 27 years is a really long time for a volunteer-powered organization to survive. I think that's pretty amazing.
Good morning.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
So it is the 27th annual festival. It is free. It is at the Cascade campus of PCC, and it runs through the 4th of March, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, matinees and evening shows. So shall we tell a little bit about what's
coming up?
We just had the opening on the festival just this Friday with a concert afterwards, two screenings. Oh, not everyone could make it in, myself included. Tracy's coming online.
Okay.
She is the director.
Okay, we'll have
Tracy
her in a minute.
Tracy is the director of the festival, and she can give you details. I'll just give you an outline, which is that we have the documentary night is coming up next. It starts with a matinee this Thursday, the 9th of February. Tracy, you, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Great. Hello. I'll just finish the outline a little more. The Student Fest matinee is on the 16th. That is a Thursday. And centerpiece of the film from Egypt, we'll get details on that, is coming up on the 17th. And then documentary night again with a matinee preceding it on the 23rd. All of this is online. We'll give the details of the website. And don't forget the Women's Filmmakers Week, with matinee preceded by the Family Fest matinee on the 25th, with Baba Wage in control there.
So, Tracy, you are the keeper of the details on some of these films, and you've joined us on KBU many times, both of you, to talk about this film festival. And again, I can't stress enough about how impressive it is for this to continue 27 years. And I wanted to point out, before I forget, that the website itself is really a great community resource, and there's a film collection there, but more information just about African cinema, about other festivals around the country, and it's really a great library for folks to study up on what's happening with African film. So, Tracy, you had some films that you wanted to talk about in detail.
Yeah, definitely. Well, to start with, he just mentioned our Women's Filmmaker Week, which normally we have a week at the end of the festival where we showcase female directors. This year, we had so many amazing female-directed films. Our films actually exceed the Women's Filmmaker Week, which was really a great thing this year. And speaking of which, we have a great film on the 17th. We said our centerpiece film, Nawara, from Egypt, is also directed by a woman, and it's a fantastic film looking at post-revolution Egypt from the point of view of a maid who works for a wealthy family who flees the country, and she's left alone to take care of their mansion with quite a bit of spending money, and it really highlights the class differences that kind of fueled the revolution are still happening in Egypt right now. And then this week we have a lot of exciting stuff. We have a great documentary, Hassan Habre, on Thursday evening. And Friday we have an
7 p.m., by the way. Don't be late or you won't get a seat.
That's true. Yeah, we fill up very quickly for our film, so please get there early and get a seat. We squeeze in as many people as the fire code allows, but...
And the festival has grown. You have thousands of people participate over the course of the month.
We get 2 weeks off a year where we're not involved in the planning and the acquisition.
Right. Okay.
And it's known worldwide.
I think Tracy is protesting. Somebody gets 2 weeks off.
That's right.
Yeah, last year we had around 5,000 people attend festival, and everything is completely free and open to the community. And yeah, this week we have a new thing as well on Saturday for the first time. So this year we kind of are going beyond film. So opening night we had a fabulous concert with a great guitarist from Niger collaborating with Portland musicians. It was a beautiful thing to see in this time, having this cross-cultural collaboration happening and dancing to it.
And that was at the Hollywood Theater.
Yeah,
ice
it was
not
a wild time.
Slowing us down.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and then this Saturday also we're collaborating with Boom Arts to show two stage readings of new African plays from South Africa and Nigeria in the afternoon. And you can make a whole day of it. Come to the plays, stay for our Saturday social hour at 5:30 with food, live music, shopping. And then our 7 p.m. film this Saturday is one of my favorites. It's called Kati Kati, and it is a Kenyan film. And it takes place in the afterlife, but the afterlife in this film is a small village, and no one knows why they're, how they got there or anything about their lives. It's a really beautiful, interesting film, and really imaginative. So I'm very excited about that, too.
In our last minute here, can you just comment a little bit about the importance of the African Film Festival to Black History Month? And it, as I understand it, it's always been at this time of the year from its inception, and just so folks have a sense of that importance.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, BC, do you want to talk a little about?
Well, I just wanted to say, while you were thinking about it, the films are gathered from around the world, African film through African eyes and about Africa. And I just wanted to say that people should attend these films to learn about not only Africa, because it's many countries in Africa, but when you're looking at Africa, you're looking also at what's going on in this country. So don't think about them as those people over there. Go ahead, Tracy.
I think that's a great way to look at it. I mean, part of this festival is looking at ways that you can empathize with other cultures and other people through film and finding the commonalities as well. And I think it's particularly at this time in our country, it's really important that all people come to this festival and just to connect with and understand other people and other cultures, and also have a place for community to come together and have these, we have these great after film discussions, and to let your voice be out and have these great, great talks after as well, I think is really important.
And if you come early enough at 5:30, you can join in shopping at the market just outside the doors.
Excellent. Thank you both for joining me this morning, PC Perry, Tracy Francis, and folks, get out and see these films and do, as they say, heed the warning. Get there early to get your place.
Thank
Wonderful,
you for having
institution. African Film Festival from now until March 4th. Free
and
open
free,
to the public.
Free.
Free. Thank you both.
Not cheap.
Thanks so much.
Normally feel like I don't wanna know her. but I've been feeling the change. Get out my way, man, I just wanna grow up. Oh, trying to fix my place, I once saw in a dream. Poker art, sun, bloody left the sun.
That is Season Change, Ghost Poet. I was just talking about the African Film Festival. We're going to switch now to teaching in a time of Trump. I have Pat McCreary on the phone, social studies teacher in high school. You're on the line, correct?
Hi there.
Yeah, hi. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. You are a high school social studies teacher. It sounds like the social studies teachers are leading the charge here on teaching in the time of Trump.
Yeah.
That makes some sense.
Many of us, we're teaching the election this year, and so it just kind of is a natural extension of the curriculum that we do.
Excellent. Well, there is a teach-in coming up. It is on Saturday, February 11th. It is at Madison High School. It's four teachers teaching social justice or transformative social justice in the schools. And I wanted to have you just talk a little bit about the collective that has been organizing this event. And then we'll just talk about the event and the goals for the teach-in.
Sure. Sounds great. And thank you for having us today. The Critical Educators Collective is a group that I've been lucky enough to be able to work with. I'm not part of the group, but it's a group that was founded in 2015 by a group of graduate students at Lewis and Clark's College School of Education. And they've since expanded a bit to include teachers from throughout the Portland area. And they're a group that focuses on social justice education, looking at the teacher's role in the classroom as one of being responsible for helping students navigate the complex world around them, and to give them the skills that they need to break through some of the social and cultural barriers that are sometimes placed in front of them. So I was fortunate to get to work with some of these teachers in my own school, and then with them we have started planning the teach-in and are very excited for it this Saturday.
And so as far as the actual content of the teach-in and mobilizing for social justice teaching, but against the increasing tendency towards privatization. We have this horrible Secretary of Education being paraded as, you know, the champion of privatization and religion and all of this stuff. So there's a lot of fight to have happen. But, you know, the collective has been around since 2015. So teaching for social justice isn't new. But now there's perhaps a gathering storm and an opportunity to draw in more teachers. So what will be the goals of the teach-in?
Yeah, great question. Social justice education is not new. In fact, many of us believe that education is in and of itself a political act just because it's founded on the belief that we are all worthy and we have the right to an education. So the goals of the teach-in, quite honestly, are two-part. Number one is to hear from some folks in the community who are most at risk of potential harm from the Trump administration. And then the second part is really to break into smaller work groups based on some of those specific areas, with the idea being we will develop next steps. So we're going to have teachers hopefully work on forming action plans for what comes next.
I hear actual school happening in the background.
You do. So. These are our daily announcements happening in the background, and I apologize.
No, we like that. Yeah, we like to have a piece of real life happening. Well, I appreciate you joining us. We'll have to end there. I will re-announce this at the end of the program with the website, but this is Teaching in the Time of Trump. It's Saturday, February 11th, for teachers who want to explore new and exciting ways to teach social justice and to push back on the evil forces against private schools or public schools. Right. Well, Pat McCreary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll just go right to Desiree then. Desiree Helligers with her guests from the panel on Standing Rock, Lessons Learned. We have Jacqueline Keeler, Diana Yankton, Dakota journalist and activist, Robin White, Cheyenne Lakota artist and activist, Maya Jared, organizer with 350PDX and activist Mike Horner. The panel was facilitated by Deborah Leave. This is the portion of the panel on Standing Rock, Lessons Learned.
Okay, so now we get to the real meat of this panel, I think. From an outsider's perspective, it was amazing to watch the coalitions that were built and people coming together, the various tribes, labor, veterans, environmental groups, coming together and all joining forces. What are some of those lessons that were learned? So So let's see. Let's start with down with Mike this time.
You know, there's a lot of weight given to maintaining a prayerful position in the situation, which is incredibly hectic and stressful and dangerous, actually. And yet, there was a lot of effort given to not giving into anger and becoming, you know, combative and confrontational with the police, even while they're shooting at you and beating you and spraying you and doing just unbelievably brutal things. It was a beautiful example of nonviolent direct action, and was, you know, to me that was the thing that I came away with, was the discipline of being able to stand in front of brute force and not react is so unbelievably powerful. The people, that is the way to capture the moral high ground. Do not react. Do not fight back. You know, let them show themselves for who they really are, and we will win.
So my perspective on the lessons that I've learned from visiting Standing Rock, but mostly just seeing how the fight is being fought, and the background that I have in fighting fossil fuel infrastructure out here, my first lesson that I learned is that we are making an impact. At Standing Rock, it's extremely visible right now, the impact, the problem that people are creating for the fossil fuel industry. And that repression and violent repression using means other than violence and violent repression, are increasing regardless of the tactics that are being used, regardless of whether people are being peaceful, regardless of whether people are being lawful, that moneyed interests and people in power are willing to take means necessary to make sure that nothing stands in their way. And the basis of what that repression looks like is different and will be different for native resistors to fossil fuel infrastructure and white resistors to fossil fuel infrastructure. We need to pay attention and wake up that it doesn't matter if we're taking legal means to resist these extractive and violent interests, that eventually, when we're effective, there will be repression. And I think that that's really important to remember, one, because it changes how we view other people's efforts in resisting fossil fuel infrastructure or fascism, because regardless of what efforts people are choosing in how they resist these forces, there will be repression, and so we need to support each other in whatever choices we make. A second thing I learned that I'm excited about is fossil fuel industry is massive. Each corporation has branches all over the world, usually. Their extraction sites, their refining sites, their gas stations, whatever. The banks have branches all over the world or all over the country. They're enormous, enormous entities. But something that was really awesome that came out of the fight at Standing Rock is that the organizers actually used that size against their opponents. So they made call-outs for actions to happen all around the country and all around the world and said, Wells Fargo is a bank that's involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline. Let's target every single branch of Wells Fargo, because not everyone who wants to help resist the Dakota Access Pipeline can make it to Standing Rock, but they have a branch of Wells Fargo where they live. So let's use this massive entity's size and flip it on its back and make sure that they're targeted everywhere they exist. We need to learn from that. So we're fighting huge entities, fossil fuel corporations, the banks that fund them, you name it. Pick your fight. You're fighting huge moneyed interests, but let's use that against them. I want to work on how to apply that to other fights that are going on.
You know, for me, this is a Standing Rock is a pilgrimage. I think everyone who goes there is going on a pilgrimage to an idea, to a better world. I think that makes me very proud of our Lakota people. I was talking to a friend of mine. She's also a journalist. She's Bogalala. And she was saying that no matter everything they did to us, everything they tried to do to us to make us less than we were, and you see our cultures standing off against each other, and you can clearly see which is the better culture, you know? And so, you know, I think that for Indian people, for local and Tocantinsis people, this is an exhilarating moment. And it's the moment where all of our prophecies are coming, all of our prayers. My aunt, she's an elder in the Ocheti Shukkoan Elders Council, and she was saying that, you know, all those prayers they did at the ghost dance, so they're finally, they're traveling here, they're coming here. This is coming about, you know. And you know, I don't really, when, in my reporting, I mean, the spiritual stuff to me is extremely private. But definitely everything that's being done there is being done in ceremony, and the decisions are being made in ceremony. And I do ask everyone here to recognize the reemergence of the Great Sioux Nation, of the Ocheti Shukkoan, and just what a miraculous thing it is, how hard we fought, and how badly we suffered for generations. And so I think that it's a fragile thing, too. It's something that should be nurtured, should be cared for. The trauma that those frontline communities, like the people of Cannonball, are going through is real, and they're taking that hit for all of you, and you should honor that and not take it for granted. But for me, as a Dakota woman, as a Native woman, I'm very proud of the contributions, the socio-cultural contributions that Indigenous cultures have made to the world today. The modern ideas that we have are the result of exchange, a cultural exchange that happened between the colonists from the 13 original colonies, or 12, I guess, and much of it with the Iroquois Confederacy. My husband is here today. He is a member of the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. His grandfather was the chief of the Bear Clan Mohawk, and represented their nation at the UN. And, you know, I think that, you know, the ideas of democracy, I mean, you're coming from a feudal society in Europe and Asia. Are our leaders ruled by their tongue, by their ability to speak and move the hearts of the people? They didn't have standing armies. They didn't have force. We voted with our feet. And that's what everyone who goes to Standing Rock is doing on a certain level. They're voting with their feet. And they're voting for what they want, how they want this world to be ordered. And that place where Standing Rock is extremely special. But that is where the pipeline is being built, is where the white buffalo calf woman came to us. She came to us, she gave us the pipe, and it was at that, my Lala used to say, it's at that point that we became Lakota and Dakota. Before that, we weren't. Before she came and gave us the pipe, the chalupa, and gave us the seven sacred ceremonies, including the sun dance, at that point, we became Lakota Dakota. And I think this is what a real people are. They are people who are formed by a spiritual experience that connects them to the land and forms them their relationship to it. I think being a colony and being profit motive driven, you know, as, you know, Trump is the absolute epitome of that whole, you know, prosperity gospel that America is built on, that's a very different paradigm than what our people have. And I think that once again, a cultural exchange needs to happen. Later, women's rights was inspired by the Seneca women. The women of Seneca Falls saw there was a Seneca village adjacent to Seneca Falls, New York. And they, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, when she saw that the Seneca women got to reorder their government, a lot of our cultures are clan-based, matrilineal-based. So the women are in charge. And so she saw that, and it made it real to her that actually women could have equal rights. And if you read the speeches they did at Seneca Falls, they talk about that Iroquois community. They're like, we want what they have, you know? We see it every day, and we want it, you know? And so we have to realize the great debt that modernism, that the ideas that we go out in the world, we say, you should honor your women, you should, you know, you should have democracy. You know, these came out of these exchanges, just like the kind of exchange that's happening at Standing Rock. And I think that people, you know, need to honor that exchange. And one morning I woke up at camp, and it was dawn, and they were doing a call to prayer. And they're urging everyone to come and bring their child with us. And hundreds of cars lined up. It was like a traffic jam in the morning at dawn. But all these people, all these Indian people and their allies, were going to work. They were going to make a stand. Stand for the water. The Neely Shawnee would come. You know, water is sacred. And it was really amazing. And as they were leaving, I could hear over the loudspeaker in camp, they were playing John Trudell. We hear his voice. He's a Dakota, Santee Dakota poet. He passed away. And it was his voice. And he has this, if you're familiar with his poetry, you've heard his voice. He's very incantatory. He says things until he has the meaning deepens, you know. And he was saying, "We are the people of the earth. Who are you?" And as all the people were driving away, it was obvious then that we were the people of the earth.
I think it was 29 winds, I think, in the Northwest have been directly related to tribal sovereignty and treaty rights. That's important. But, you know, these you've got to understand these governments are also, they have to deal with a lot of other governments and a lot of other government entities. They're stretched pretty thin. So you need to be good allies to them, particularly when it's not in your favor. You know, these tribes need assistance. They need allies. They need good allies for the long term. So, you know, please try and remember that. You know, we've got unions. The AFL, the leader of the AFL-CIO, the leader of Labor's International Union, the Teamsters, the UA Plumbers, and I think somebody else, but I can't remember at the moment, actually came out not only in favor of the pipeline, but mostly disturbing, called the people who were there extremists, and were saying that it was all right that they got attacked by dogs. They were saying things like, well, you know, you shouldn't have had women and children there. Why would you take them to Afghanistan? Last time I checked, I don't think we're in Afghanistan, and I don't think we're at war. Well, we kind of are, but not technically. So, you know, but the good thing about it is a lot of the rank and file members said no. Of those unions, and sure, there was other unions that just stood up and said, absolutely no, this isn't right, we need to support these people. But the rank and file people from those unions and from the building trades actually said no. And they went out there and they sacrificed and they raised money. They did things to do. And now they're talking about putting their money where their mouth is and doing some things. So I think that's extraordinary. And I think that shows you that if that institution can start changing as well, I think that we have hope for the rest of those institutions. You know, there was a lot of other organizations, medical people. You know, we're talking about, some of us are talking about making it so as these things crop up, whether it's in Texas, Klamath, so on and so forth, these different areas, that we can send medical teams and emergency teams down there right off the bat. They're already ready to go. So that we're not reinventing the wheel on these things all the time. So, you know, there's a lot of relationships that have developed that I think as we move forward are going to make it easier for us to go out and to be there to fight these things. The only thing we have to watch out for is, are we strong enough and are we together enough to fight our own government to where they don't make it illegal and legal to, you know, shoot white people as well as red people when we do these. So good things.
For years this legend has been told of a creature seldom seen. He leaves a footprint so immense it could make a grown man scream. Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Yeti, he goes by all those names. But now there's something scarier and our world's not quite the same. There are beasts who are leaving footprints that make Bigfoot's track look small. And they're messing up our atmosphere, so heed this wake-up call. We call them carbon footprints and they're made of CO2. And who's leaving these big footprints? Well, I'm afraid it's me and you. So here's what to do and here's what to watch. Don't be a carbon Sasquatch.
That is Carbon Sasquatch, Schoolhouse Rock's Earth. There's much more Schoolhouse Rock than I realized. That's new and exciting. And we're having some fun with that this morning. Next on The Old Mole, two interviews by Bill Resnick on community energy and how it can vastly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and save the planet. The first is with Rebecca Clausen. The second shorter interview is with Erica Idelson, and a continuation of an interview that began last week. We'll start now with Rebecca Clausen and Bill Resnick on community energy.
Hi, Rebecca Clausen. Welcome to KABU.
Hi, Bill. Thanks so much for having me on.
Rebecca, I just read an article about you on Grist, a webzine on the environment. The title was Meet the Mom Leading the Fight Against Fracking in Santa Barbara. That was a couple of years ago. As to that title, I'm not sure why Grist thinks it's so unusual and amazing that a woman can bear and raise a child and also be an activist and a leader, too. But that's another issue. Anyway, Rebecca is a great activist organizer. She's worked for a number of environmental organizations. She's involved in many other struggles, particularly in California, over who owns the sun and the wind, and who will run the emerging solar and wind energy systems, more specifically the battle in Santa Barbara to create Central Coast Power. It would take over the electric power system in the three counties and make Santa Barbara and the counties 100% renewable in a relatively short time. She's also on the steering committee for the Statewide Alliance for Community Energy. Rebecca, first, tell us how you got involved with fracking and California politics on water and fracking. What's happening now? And then we can discuss community energy and why it is so important.
Sure. So about 6 years ago, I moved back to my home county of Santa Barbara and not only saw that the climate had changed, but also that frackers had big hopes to develop and to frack in this county. So I joined with some friends who are also very alarmed, and we started organizing. We grew to a list of about 1,000 volunteers in a relatively short time, about a year, and decided to take our issue to the ballot to try to ban fracking and extreme energy production here in Santa Barbara County, because Governor Brown was not willing to do so. He was not willing to protect our communities and our groundwater. We took it to the ballot. We were defeated by about $7 million of big oil and industry money. But we didn't let that stop us. We carried on. We took all that momentum and started pushing for 100% renewable Santa Barbara County. We've joined with Ventura County and neighboring San Luis Obispo County to study what it would take to get all three counties 100% renewable in a short time, one or two decades. And that's how I got involved.
Uh-huh. As to the fracking, Santa Barbara suffered the great oil spill, what, about 10 or 15 years ago? There have been other oil spills. How do they get the water for this fracking, and how does that whole system work, and why is it so dangerous?
Sure. So our region has a long history of oil production. We were the first place where people tried to drill, or thought to drill, into the ocean floor, actually. And we suffered an oil spill 45 years ago, the first major oil spill offshore. And then again, in 2015, the Refugio oil spill was caused by an offshore oil pipeline leaking. Water is a large concern. We are still suffering from the drought, even though the state has gotten a lot of water this year. Santa Barbara County tends to be a little drier than the rest of the coast region. And so there's a lot of concern that we don't have the water necessary to continue with this dangerous forms of oil extraction that use a ton of water. So steam injection is one form that uses even more water than hydraulic fracturing does. And they're doing that extensively in our county, and they have plans to drill up to 700 more of these kinds of wells in the next year. So we're standing with North County community members who are facing these new oil projects in their backyards, trying to support their efforts to get these projects denied. We had a big win last year. For the first time ever, Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors voted to deny an oil project. It was a 233 new oil well project that would have used steam fracking. And we want to continue that trend and stand up to the oil interests that would prefer to put our groundwater at risk.
You're getting a lot of support, right, from farmers and people, especially people who live in the countryside and aren't being served by city systems. Their groundwater is the most endangered, right? In fact, they're just taking the groundwater, even if it wasn't so toxic, what they spill and then re-inject. They're taking people's groundwater. It's unbelievable, actually, in a place like Santa Barbara.
Yes, it is very concerning. It's very concerning that we don't have a system in place that would prioritize best use for groundwater. Of course, the industry is also using recycled water, and that's what you'll hear over and over again from them. They're using reclaimed water from sanitation districts, but they also are using groundwater, and that is in direct competition with farmers as well as local residents who rely 100% on their wells.
Yeah, and streams and fish and wildlife and trees. This is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Hour. Rebecca Clausen and I have been talking about how California, allegedly so green as on the environment, is allowing fracking all over the state, although it can be banned by local counties. And further, green California appears now to be undermining part of its former glory, a piece of legislation that allows cities and counties, in fact, any jurisdiction, the legislation offers the opportunity of community choice to take over electricity systems in their jurisdiction, which allows them both to lower costs and contract for themselves and construct sun and wind electricity generating facilities. Rebecca, you're also active in the Santa Barbara and the neighboring counties campaign to set up a community electric energy district. Why are you doing it? Why is it so important?
It's incredibly important. The timeline for climate change demands that we take action now and transition to 100% renewable energy as soon as possible. So I see this as a huge opportunity, not only to green up our act and lower our carbon footprint, but also to make a stand politically that we've had enough, that business as usual can no longer continue. And it helps the common person realize that it is possible to be 100% clean and green now. We don't have to continue to allow these fossil fuel companies to extract in our backyards at the expense of our health and well-being. So I see it both as a very tangible way of creating positive climate impact, but also as a strategic campaign move to help people visualize a clean, green future.
How does it get set up? It's a vote of the, is it the county supervisors, or is it the, is it a vote by the people, or both?
So the way we're doing it here, we've secured supportive votes from all three county supervisors. So then the jurisdictions will form what's called a joint powers authority, and that agency will be able to purchase power and distribute it to our residents. And our elected officials will be able to make decisions about what type of energy we want on the grid. So my job on the ground as an organizer is to make sure that the community's voices, the people demanding 100% renewable options, are heard loud and clear so that our elected officials know that that's what we want out of this project.
And you can also have the power, my understanding is, you have the power to raise resources or bonding or however it would be done to construct your own facilities in all over the county. And generally these would be, we talked about it earlier, rooftop solar is what you're pushing for. That is really small installations, but all networked and confederated. Tell us how that would work.
We've mapped out solar PV resources sufficient enough to generate all the electricity we would need, at least for the Santa Barbara County portion, where we do mostly rooftop parking lots and then a few solar farms here and there to supplement. So what we would do is generate, store, and distribute 100% renewable energy right here within the region. The beauty of community choice energy is that we can become a power providing agency, raise revenue, and then reinvest that revenue in local generation projects.
You know, in California, you can also reinvest, my understanding is, into changes in transportation systems or putting up light rail or other ways so you're making a clean energy transit system. Not completely, because you need some electric cars, but it seems to me that community energy is just this wonderful recipe for creating a public agency that will make sure that of conservation, of transit, of changing agricultural patterns, and of building a culture where people see themselves as really supporting in many ways this much healthier environment that they would live in, as well as paying less for the electricity.
Absolutely. There's a huge amount of potential with community choice energy. It's a very powerful project if done right.
This is KBOO Radio, Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Rebecca Clausen, who is a community activist struggling with the frackers in Santa Barbara County and mid-state. We've been discussing both the opposition to fracking as well as the wonderful, actually, consequences of going towards community choice and community energy. Rebecca Clausen, who's the opposition and how are they operating? And what's Jerry Brown been doing in all of this?
Governor Brown must be experiencing some cognitive dissonance right about now. I do believe that he cares about climate change and is alarmed and wants to see a livable climate for future generations. But at the same time, he's fast-tracked oil fracking in Kern County in the last couple of years. He allows oil wastewater to be used to irrigate even organic crops. The Aliso Canyon natural gas explosion last year, he refuses to shut that facility down, even though there are still thousands of people who are sick and getting nosebleeds 18 months later. His sister is on the board of Sempra Energy, the parent company for SoCal Gas, responsible for that disaster. So there are just many ways that Governor Brown has not been the environmental or climate champion that he's perceived to be. Another aspect of this that ties into what we're talking about is the fact that he is committed to the current cap and trade system, even though the last 2 years has proven ineffective at decreasing emissions. There's a study that recently came out showing that environmental justice communities, frontline communities, have actually suffered under our cap and trade system. But Governor Brown just seems like he's got blinders on. He wants funding for the bullet train that would allow people to ride a speed rail from the Bay Area to LA and back. Meanwhile, we don't have the time to experiment with this market-based approach. We need him to use his executive authority to keep dangerous fossil fuels in the ground and put all of his time and effort into supporting communities that want to generate 100% renewable energy like ours. So to your question about what he's done on community choice energy, Governor Brown's appointed the members to the Public Utilities Commission, and they've made a few important decisions that promote the utilities over programs like Community Choice Energy. One example is the transmission access charge. So say we generate solar PV electricity for 10 cents a kilowatt hour. The state requires that we tack on another 3 cents just because SoCal Edison has to maintain their transmission grid. Even if we don't use their grid, they're charging us for it. That's one way that the Public Utilities Commission has made community choice energy projects and locally generated electricity a lot harder. It's harder to compete on the market when we're being penalized by such a large amount. Another example is the power charge and difference adjustment. Every customer who was ever on the grid, a customer of the major utility, is charged retroactively when they decide to leave and go with a community choice energy project.
They're charged retroactively. And what's the charge?
I can't recall the exact amount right now. There are several different small charges that add up to basically penalizing community choice energy projects and making them less competitive on the market with these dirty fossil fuel utilities.
And the Public Utility Commission in California appears to be captured by the three big investor-owned utilities and their financiers. I think you can't ignore the fact that Goldman Sachs and the rest of it makes a very steady, it's sort of their baseline profit is in financing electricity, because depression or not, whatever happens to the rest of the country, those charges are paid. Modern society can't do without electricity. And the financiers don't want to lose their huge bite on the system. On the other hand, there are people like you and thousands of others who are challenging that whole system of basically crony capitalism. Rebecca Clausen, it's great what you're doing. It's so important. You're doing a lot to guarantee that there is a future. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill. I appreciate it.
My hero, Zero, such a funny little hero, but till you came along, we counted on our fingers and toes. Now you're here to stay, and nobody really knows how wonderful you are. While we can
That's the Lemonheads with My Hero Zero, another Schoolhouse Rock. That's Schoolhouse Rock Rocks, if folks want to look that up. That was Bill Resnick with Rebecca Clausen on community energy. And next on The Old Mole, we have a short interview, the second part of an interview on how the big electric companies are trying to destroy community energy. That aired last week. This is the end of that interview with Erica Idelson, who is a writer, community activist in Oakland, California, and is the co-founder of the Alliance for Community Energy. That's the California Alliance for Community Energy.
One final issue. The big utilities see community choice aggregation as a tremendous threat to them, and of course it is, because if people start getting their energy from their local democratically run supplier at lower rates, it puts the not just the utilities out of business, but the big financial firms. Financing public utilities is a tremendous source of profit for the bond market. It's regular, it's riskless, and it makes huge amounts of money, and everybody pays in. They're staunchly against community energy. And in California, it seems to me it's very visible. Tell us about the opposition and how Jerry Brown, who has a good record on most things, has been very disappointing.
Well, there has been very strong monopoly utility opposition from day one, ever since the enabling legislation was passed in 2002. And so it took a good 6 or 7 years before the first community choice program was even able to launch, because there was so much pushback and kind of smear campaigns and disinformation to really try and prevent that first program from launching. But once that first program did launch and was pretty immediately successful after a few years, then it was a different ball game, and other programs started launching all over the state. But the utilities are still constantly coming up with ways to try and undermine what we're doing. Sometimes that's at the local level with a particular program, and there have been a couple of instances where they've sponsored statewide legislation. They have failed both times. They have spent millions and millions of dollars.
I read $46 million on one initiative.
Yeah. In 2010, they spent $46 million. They lost.
And our side has about 100,000. That was...
Right. So that shows, you know, people get it. People want it. They tried again a few years later with a bill in our state legislature, and that also failed. And now they're kind of doing more devious things. We'll start to get too technical for people, but there's things that they're doing with the Public Utilities Commission, where they're getting that commission, which, as you mentioned, is appointed by Governor Brown, and they're getting the commission to rubber stamp a lot of bogus charges that they're slapping on people's bills, so that even after you leave a utility for your local community choice program, that utility can still continue to slap a monthly exit fee on you, sort of as a penalty for having left the utility. There's a lot of complex reasons about why they're able to get away with that, but it's actually amounting to hundreds of millions of dollars being lost every year, transferred from community choice customers back to the utilities. So that's a major problem that we still need to fix, and that's, at this point, one of the biggest ways that the utilities are still working against this. They kind of talk out of both sides of their mouth, and they say, oh, you know, we're neutral on community choice. But, you know, as you mentioned, they're not neutral, because they're losing all of their customers. Now, they're not going to completely go under as a result of community choice, because they still deliver the electricity through their transmission lines, and they still do the billing. So what's changing really primarily is the procurement, so that the community choice program is making the decisions about where the electricity comes from, which is the most important thing. But the utility is still carrying the electricity over its line. So they still have a role to play, but it's not as profitable a role as they're accustomed to, and they're no longer a monopoly as they're accustomed to. So now people who live in a community choice jurisdiction have a choice. They can either stay with their utility that they've always had, or they can switch over to the new community choice program and give that a try. And Sure, of course, a utility doesn't, a monopoly does not want to stop being a monopoly. So, yes, there is opposition.
Yeah, despite all of their public-spirited announcements and pretensions, I just want to say one final thing. Jerry Brown did take on Trumpism and says we're going to continue along our path, and invited other states to join them, including, of course, one of the states right adjacent to it, a little bit north, is Oregon. It's not clear to me. We do not have community choice legislation in Oregon. It would be wonderful to have it and to give communities that opportunity. We'll have to talk about that another time. It was really wonderful to talk to you, Erica Edelson. And check out her blog, and she writes on a lot of things, and the pieces I've read have all been really interesting. How do we get to your blog?
Oh, well, my website is ericaedelson.com, E-R-I-C-A-E-T-E-L-S-O-N. And I would also invite people who want to learn more about community choice energy to go to cacommunityenergy.org. That's the California Alliance for Community Energy website. And feel free to get in touch. If people in Oregon want to start trying to move this forward, we would be happy to support you.
Thanks so much for talking to us today. Erica
Thank
Edelson.
You.
Yes.
Okay.
So long.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. And we want to thank KBOO members for your generous support. And if you are not a current member, you can become one. Go to KBOO.fm and click on Donate. I have some announcements. I want to remind folks that the African Film Festival is currently running. It started February 3rd and it runs through March 4th. It is free and open to the public at Cascade Campus, Portland Community College. You can Google African Film Festival and you'll find a whole host of things on that website, including an archive of past African films. Critical Educators Collective, you can go to criticaleducatorscollective.com, the teach-in, Teaching in a Time of Trump. This is for educators only, February 11th, 8:30 to 1 p.m. at Madison High School. And I also want to point out that the Hollywood Theater also has a Black Film Festival. It's a two-week festival starting February 9th through 22nd, and you can go to their website to find out information on all of those films, documentaries, narrative, and even a music film, Sign of the Times, Prince. A good festival. Please check that out. This has been Denise Morris, my engineer this morning, Patsy Kohlberg. Thank you very much, and we'll be back next week.